It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at the booming sand mining industry in Wisconsin. The Wall Street Journal calls our state the Saudi Arabia of silica, supplying the sand that's used in fracking operations around the country.
First, a new report suggests that young people aren't interested in running for elected office. In fact, it's last on their list of jobs they want, and at the top of the list of jobs they actually don't want.
Our guest is worried about what that means for the future of representative government. Jennifer Lawless is with us. She's co-author of the study, and she's professor of government and director of the Women and Politics Institute at American University. Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
In the study, you surveyed high schoolers and college students, over 4,000 of them. What did you find?
The general conclusion was that politics is at the bottom of the list. Only about 11% of the 4,200 high school and college students that we interviewed said that they were interested in running for office later in life.
And that they might be interested, as I read it, not that
right.
They for sure would. Yeah,
absolutely.
Is this different than previous generations? Did we used to be more run for office minded?
It's difficult to know because surveys haven't really asked young people about their political ambition. We do know that they've been civically engaged over the course of the last 50 years, and our research indicates the same is true. These young people do want to improve their communities. They want to help make the world a better place, but the evidence is pretty compelling that they don't think of electoral politics as an effective route by which to do so.
So I guess the big question is, why? Why are young people turned off to politics, to running for office?
I think a lot of it has to do with the current political environment. They look around and they don't like politicians. They don't see effective policies. They see gridlock. They see hyperpartisanship and a lot of bickering. And they're surrounded by parents and teachers and other adults in their lives who are equally turned off. If you look at recent polls over the course of the last year, congressional approval has hit an all-time low. Barack Obama's approval ratings have reached an all-time low. And we've also seen a government shutdown. We've seen ineffective party wrangling over a wide variety of issues. We've seen stymied political appointments. There's very little out there to suggest that politics is a noble profession.
We'll dig more into the reasons here and the attitudes, but why does this make you worried?
The main problem is that in the United States, there are more than 500,000 elective offices. And the health of democracy is predicated on the fact that good qualified people will run for these positions and electoral competition will hold them accountable. So if the best and the brightest are not interested in pursuing this in the future, it really questions whether we're going to have the high quality elected officials we need to continue to move the country in the right direction.
How much do you think our actual elected officials should be blaming themselves for the way they talk about politics, approach politics, and deal with partisan conflict?
I think it really is the fault of the elected officials. They have given Americans a laundry list of reasons to be dissatisfied with the way that they're running the country. That's not to say that they didn't get into politics for the right reasons, but I do think that we've reached a point in time where government dysfunction has suggested that no normal, sane person would want to throw his or her hat into the ring. And so the only people that can change that and the only way people can elevate the discourse is if these elected officials realize the consequences of their actions and that the consequences of their actions transcend policy. They're also turning off an entire generation.
Is this really that new? I know we can't really track this attitude over time, but isn't there a sense that young people are always turned off by politics in one way or another, or is this maybe a newer phenomenon?
Well, given that there seems to be a very big relationship between whether adults have suggested to young people that they think about running for office and the young people's attitudes toward running, I think we might have reached a problem that is not typical and has not been seen over the course of the last several decades, because we do know that adults who are in a position to encourage young people to run for office are more turned off now than they've been over the course of the last 50 years. So I do think the situation is a little bit more grave. But that said, sometimes it's calling attention to these issues that can really change the situation. So maybe if people realize the consequences of the current levels of dissatisfaction, they'll try to turn those around.
That was one of the things you surveyed, right? You asked the students, Are there adults in your life, parents, counselors, whatever, suggesting that you run for office?
Right. And we found that the overwhelming majority of them had nobody ever suggested to them. Parents were the most frequent recruiters, if we can call them that. And still 3 out of 4 respondents never had a parent suggest it. So when parents, teachers, coaches, religious leaders, the people with whom they work, their friends, are not encouraging them to at least think about or keep open the idea of running for office, it's very unlikely that the young people will come up with that idea on their own.
Well, Jennifer Lawless sticks with us to talk more about this report, but now I want to bring in Kelly Crombie. He's the mayor of Columbus, Wisconsin. He's 29 years old, 28 when elected. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So at what age did you know that you wanted to get into politics if you're running for mayor at age 28?
I think I always knew it at some point that I would run for office. I wasn't sure exactly when it would happen. This last March, I decided to run for mayor, and the papers came out then in December, and that's when the campaign started.
And was it common as a high school student, were you talking to your peers or a college student talking to your peers, hey, I'm going to run for office, that's what I want to do with my life? Did you hear that from people you knew at that age?
Not so much in high school, more in college, I would say, was the case. I know I was a politics and government major at Ripon College in Wisconsin. I know a couple of other of my department classmates are also hold elected office now.
And did you start preparing? Was there something you started doing in high school or college, you know, with the idea of building up your resume, building up your skills to run for office?
No, not particularly. I think that by the time I finally decided to run for mayor, I had owned a small business here in Columbus for 5 years and had just earned my law degree. So I thought it was the right time for me to jump into that.
In the poll we're talking about now, one of the questions they posed to students, they listed a whole bunch of jobs, you're going into business, a couple other things, and one of them specifically was being a mayor, which you are now, consistently ranked at the bottom of the list. That's the one job people didn't want to do. If there are younger people listening, or older people for that matter, can you make a case for, hey, being a mayor isn't such a bad job after all?
No, I think it's a great job. I think that local government is the level of government that touches people's lives the most. And I think that it's a great way to help your community and help people out.
And do you have advice for someone thinking, hey, maybe I do want to run for city council, mayor, state assembly sometime? What should they do to get their chops together before they make that run?
I think, survey the community, ask people in the community what they think. See what the issues are, and there's no harm in putting your name into the onto the ballot. Win or lose, I think it's a great opportunity to participate in democracy.
All right, Kelly, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Kelly Crombie, mayor of Columbus. Now, Jennifer Lawless, do you think that people aren't hearing stories like that enough and not hearing the case for going into elected office enough?
Absolutely. I think that's a big part of the problem. We hear all the time about the problems, the dysfunction, the disappointments. We don't hear the inspiring stories about what elected leaders can do and how they can enact policy and how electoral politics is a way to affect change in a positive way in their communities. And so hearing more about those stories and publicizing the successes, I think, is what's required to turn this around and make people realize that politics can be a noble profession, and it should be something that young people aspire to do.
One thing that would turn someone like me away from running is it looks like a lot of not fun to run for office. People take a lot of pot shots at you. When you're in office, you take a lot of blame for anything that's going wrong. How do you sell the positive side against those fairly obvious negatives?
Well, I'd say two things. The first is that part of the problem, I think, is that we tend to view politics through a national lens, when the reality is that the overwhelming majority, several hundred thousand elected offices in this country, are at the local level. And those offices often garner virtually no media attention, very little scrutiny. They're really just a way for good people to help solve problems in their communities. But we tend to think about running for president or the U.S. Senate or competitive congressional races and decide that that's off-putting. So I think sort of broadening our definition and our discussion of what electoral politics really involves is required. The other thing that I would note is that I ran for Congress in 2006 unsuccessfully, but it was the most amazing experience of my life. And although there are potshots and although there is some negative campaigning that goes on, it really pales in comparison to the incredibly inspirational stories you hear on the campaign trail and the fact that you really do find yourself in a position to affect change. So I really think that one of the things that's required is for us to bolster the positives and stop focusing so much on the negatives.
We're talking to Jennifer Lawless of American University. She's talking about her new report on why young people aren't interested in getting into running for office.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Have you ever thought about running for office? And what swayed you to run or maybe not to run? Why do you think younger people are feeling turned off by the idea of running for office? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a look at the booming sand mining industry in Wisconsin, supplying sand for natural gas and oil fracking around the country.
Now we continue our conversation with Jennifer Lawless of American University. Her new report looks at why younger Americans don't want to run for office.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Young or old, have you ever made that decision to run for office, or you thought about it and you didn't? What factors went into that decision? 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got Alex in Oregon holding on the line. Alex, hi.
Hi there. My question for Ms. Lawless is, assuming that the negative publicity that Congress is receiving is what is turning younger people off to politics, is there any possibility that it's only affecting those kids who might have been on the fence and sort of push them away, but in some ways strengthens the desire for that 11% to go into public policy and to do really good things and sort of turn the system around? Is there any positivity that can come out of it for those students who are still really committed?
So the diehards who are into politics may be more excited about running.
That's certainly possible. There's no question that predispositions matter a lot. And so the people that have an inclination or may have been at least somewhat interested in running, when they see things that are not working, they might be more inspired to turn that potential consideration into definite interest. So that's certainly a possibility. The fact remains, though, that almost 9 out of 10 people who are between the ages of 13 and 25 have already decided that this is something they don't want to do. And it's kind of concerning because when we hear 90% of people not interested in going into math or science, for example, there's a national outcry. But because politics is not seen as a noble or reputable profession, we tend not to be as concerned.
Is there also a thought that politics is too important for the politician types, that we need a certain quotient of normal people, however you want to define that?
Right, not just sort of stunted student body presidents who decide that this is what they want to do with
their lives. There's anything wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. But certainly, that's exactly the case. I think that our democracy is predicated on the idea that typical citizens who have normal needs and regular interests and are just like everybody else can actually contribute meaningfully if they hold elected office. And we see that in the nature of our system. The fact that we have so many elected positions reinforces that. So it's vital that we make sure that young people are at least thinking about it. If they decide that it's not something that they want to do, that's one thing. But if it's not occurring to them in the first place, and if they'd rather do anything else, then I think that's something for adults and politicians to seriously consider.
Alex, thanks for the call. We'll go to Randy in West Allis now. Randy, hi.
Oh, hi. I'm calling just because I've experienced politics as a participant in two phases of my life. In my early 20s, which was back in the early 1980s, I actually ran for Libertarian sheriff, Libertarian candidate for Milwaukee County Sheriff. I actually got enough signatures to get on the ballot. But boy, there's no way I would do that now with how crazy personal people take politics, with all the flames on Twitter, et cetera. And I can follow that up with a few years ago in the town where I live, there was a political dispute about street improvements, which the majority of people in our neighborhood didn't want. We ended up getting the city to compromise with what the neighborhood wanted. But just from that brief experience, I saw so many people swearing and actually saying really horrible things about other people. And unfortunately, this was a political, just a mundane political matter about whether to widen the streets. It's just, I can't imagine any rational person wanting to put themselves through that.
All right, Randy, thank you so much for bringing that up. So, yeah, it's different than it used to be, Jennifer. We can't escape the constant Twitter, Facebook, even if it's just a local office. There can be some ubiquitous, nasty response out there.
That's certainly the case, and I think it's a viable decision and completely respectable for a lot of people to decide that they don't have the personality for it or they don't want to withstand it. I am concerned that 13 to 17-year-olds, though, have already made that decision, and I think that's where there really could be room for change and room for some improvement and room to shift those young people's attitudes, because it's one thing to make a conscious decision based on a lot of information. It's another thing to have a knee-jerk reaction when you're in high school that this is something you definitely don't want to do.
Thanks for the call, Randy. Jessica in Kewaskum is on the line now. Jessica, hi.
Hi. Thank you for letting me be on, first of all. But second, I was wondering, is part of the reason why people don't want to go into office at such a young age because of the fact that it's not necessarily a secure position? You know, if you get a degree in, let's say, teaching or something like that, you're going to be a teacher. If you get a degree in politics and things like that, you have to rely on people voting for you and things like that. And in our society, it might be an issue.
Thank you, Jessica, for bringing that up. And that I always wonder about that. How do you plan for your future, for your career, if it's such a 50-50, if you're going to even have the job next year?
Right. That's an excellent point. And certainly for federal positions, that's a major issue. But most states have part-time legislatures, and most local offices, with the exception of mayor, although even many mayors, are also part-time. So the people that occupy those positions still keep their full-time jobs. And it's really sort of citizen legislatures and citizen politics. So a lot of the time, the trade-off isn't something that people are asked to do, but we perceive those trade-offs, again, because we tend to think about politics through that national lens.
Thanks, Jessica. We go now to Therese in La Crosse. Therese, hi.
Hi there. I wanted to talk about my experience running for state assembly in 1992. At that time, I was a single parent with an 18-month-old daughter, and I had the right heart and the right spirit, but I needed a better support team. It was very difficult being running a household, especially with a small child like that. I really could have used, like, and I think, I don't know if it's any different now, but I really could have used, like, help with housework, help with preparing meals, help with childcare, because there were so many demands on meeting people in the community, going to meetings, answering special interest surveys that came in the mail. It was difficult to handle all the paperwork. And I don't know if they're doing that now, but I think it was would have been very important for me as a woman to and a single parent to have help like that.
Thank you so much, Therese. And Jennifer, I know another thing you research is barriers for women in getting into politics. Can you talk to some of those points that she just brought up there?
Yeah, I mean, the bulk of my research with Richard Fox, who's at Loyola Marymount University, focuses on the gender gap in political ambition and the specific barriers that preclude women's candidate emergence. And there's no question that women operate in networks that are less conducive to their ultimate candidacies than men do, not only because they still often have childcare responsibilities and family responsibilities that they have to reconcile in a way that men still don't have to, but also because they tend not to operate in the networks that are accustomed to providing the kind of support for candidates. Men have always been the candidates, so their colleagues, their friends, the people in their circles sort of know how to support them, not only financially, but also in the nature of the campaign. And only now are we beginning to see women's organizations really develop the tools that help women achieve on those same fronts. So there's no question that the path is very different for women and men, that women are less likely to think that they're qualified in part because of that path, and that women are less likely to get recruited. The good news is that when women run, there's no systematic bias against them. They do just as well as their male counterparts. So figuring out how to encourage more women to run for office is also an important topic and an important endeavor that we need to devote ourselves to.
Jennifer, leave us with a quick thought on who needs to encourage young people to consider running for office.
I think the best thing that we can do right now is have teachers, professors, everybody on college campuses, as well as the media, highlight some of the amazing accomplishments of elected officials and encourage young people who have made it very clear that they want to affect change and improve their communities. Encourage them to see elected office as one way to do that and as a very viable way to do so. Because if we can continue to get them at least thinking about that, some of them will run, some of them will win, and some of them, I think, will become very successful and potentially change the overall perception.
Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Jennifer Lawless, professor of government at American University. We've got a link to an op-ed she co-wrote in the Washington Post. You can find that at the Central Time Facebook page, Central Time on WPR. And you can leave your thoughts on whether you would want to run for office someday while you're there. Still to come on Central Time, we'll hear how Wisconsin is a leader in the frac sand industry. Stick around, more to come. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The blog on the Wall Street Journal today called Wisconsin a Saudi Arabia when it comes to frac sand. The domestic oil boom has made Wisconsin the national leader in production of frac sand.
Kristen Jones is the co-author of the Wall Street Journal piece, In Fracking, Sand is the New Gold. She's a member of iNews in Denver. Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So we're talking about not fracking directly to get natural gas and oil in Wisconsin, but about the sand they use in it. Can you give us a sense of just how important Wisconsin has become to the frac sand industry?
Sure. Well, first of all, the frac sand industry is booming along with the oil and gas boom in the U.S. Even as natural gas prices have sort of languished and some of the air has been taken out of that part of the industry, demand for sand has just grown and grown. So energy companies are expected to use 56 billion pounds of sand this year.
56 billion.
And much of it is coming from Wisconsin.
Yeah, why Wisconsin? What is it about our sand?
You guys make great sand. it's bigger, it's rounder than sand that's coming from other places. It's just perfect for sort of keeping the fissures in the rock open so that the fuel can come out.
And what's the trend in the use of sand? Is it that as fracking goes to more and more areas, they're using more sand, or are they using more sand in each operation now?
Yeah, well, both. I mean, fracking's definitely grown in the last few years, but what energy companies are finding is that if they put even more sand into each well, then they can boost production from the well. So they're starting to experiment with just using more and more sand. The chief executive of U.S. Silica told us that it takes 25 rail cars of sand on average to frack one well.
Wow. And speaking of rail cars, we're seeing a lot more sand travel by rail. Here's a quote that kind of caught our attention. That Canadian Railway, the company, is spending $68 million to restore railways in Wisconsin, basically just to facilitate the shipping of frack sand.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be transported some way, and rail is the most efficient way to do it. There's been a bigger investment in sort of making sure those rail lines are up and running.
Are we competing with other states here, or is Wisconsin really the dominant player in frac sand?
You guys are pretty dominant. I mean, there are frac sand mines all over the country. In Iowa, there's frac sand mines in Texas. There's frac sand mines in, I think, in New Jersey. So they're everywhere. But as the industry progresses, I think the energy companies are becoming pickier and pickier about the kind of sand they want. And so they're turning more and more to Wisconsin.
And who are the players in this industry in Wisconsin and around the country?
You mean in the sand mining industry?
As far as the companies involved in doing the mining.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few companies that are doing a lot of the mining, Uniman, U.S. Silica. Those are kind of a couple of the very big operators. But you've also seen a lot of smaller companies that have gotten into the mix in the last few years because mining sand has a relatively low barrier to entry. I mean, it's hard to sort of start up operations as a fracker, but you can fairly easily, if you've got a site, you can start up operations as a sand miner.
Fracking around the country is not uncontroversial, of course. A lot of concerns about the environmental impact. Same goes for frack sand here in Wisconsin. A lot of local governments, local citizens in the western part of the state are worried about the health and environmental impacts. What kinds of developments are you seeing along those lines?
Well, certainly there's been some concern about the health impacts of silica on the workers themselves. I mean, we profiled a company called Pattison Sand that operates in Iowa and is starting up a new mine in Wisconsin that has had 775 orders and citations since it began operations. And a lot of them have had to do with overexposure to silica, to workers just being exposed to way too much silica. And silica, you know, it seems like sand seems pretty innocuous. You see it at the beach. You have your kids playing in the sandbox. But actually, crystalline silica, the very small pieces of silica, are very dangerous to inhale.
We've seen some.
So there is some concern about health.
Yeah, we've seen some concerns to regulate the industry, moratoriums from local governments here in Wisconsin. What are you seeing around the state and around the nation when it comes to environmental protection or worker protection on the silica sand mining?
Well, one of the things that's happened very recently is OSHA tightened the standards for exposure to silica. Because, what they've learned over the last few decades is that it takes a lot less silica than they originally thought to cause risks of disease, especially silicosis. So that's one thing that's happening. You see less regulation when it comes to sort of ambient exposure to silica. Partly, I mean, there isn't an established threshold for what is an okay amount of silica to inhale if you're living by a sand mine, for instance. So a lot of the opposition has come from local areas, as you've seen in Wisconsin.
And we've seen that in Wisconsin. Is that that kind of local opposition, either from local governments or local citizens groups? Are you seeing that elsewhere in the country?
You know, you're seeing it again because a lot of the sand mines are concentrated in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. A lot of the opposition is also in Wisconsin, too.
So any signs of this sand mining boom slowing down anytime in the near future?
Not really. I mean, even, as the energy boom has slowed in some ways, the sand mining industry has just continued to boom. A couple of the companies, the public companies, have seen real profits from selling sand. Shares of U.S. Silica have doubled since it went public in 2012. Shares of Hi-Crush Partners have jumped 60%, almost 60% since it began trading in August 2012. Who knows? But right now it doesn't show any signs of slowing.
We've talked a little about environmental and health impacts of these mines. What is your sense of the economic impact that they're having in the sand mining regions?
It depends who you talk to, but the sand mines are certainly draw attention to the amount of economic activity that's going around that comes from the sand mines. I mean, it's not only the mines themselves that are employing people, it's also the truckers. The rail industry, as you mentioned. So you are seeing an economic impact from the mines.
Kristen, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
That's Kristen Jones. She's co-author of a Wall Street Journal piece. It's called In Fracking, Sand is the New Gold. She's a member of the iNews team with PBS in Denver, Colorado. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In the first year of Wisconsin's two-year legislative session, thousands of bills have been introduced in the state assembly and the state senate.
Only about 100 of those bills have been passed by the legislature. Only half of those have been signed into law.
So what's left for the remaining year of the current session? Well, we'll find out now with Bill Leaders, reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Bill, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here again.
So are you surprised that they got through so few bills?
Oh, no, it's not an especially unproductive session. This always happens that many more bills are introduced than become law. In fact, one of the primary functions of the legislature, besides passing bills, is to not pass them, to keep certain things from happening. And that is the fate of most legislation that gets proposed. There is about 900, between 900 and 1,000 individual bills that have been introduced so far this session. And as you said, only about 100 of them have passed the legislature. There'll be some more bills that pass in the coming session, but what I did for the column that I wrote this week is I just did a sampling of some of the bills that haven't passed yet and took a look at what they would do and where they are in the process.
Let's jump into some of those bills. One of the ones you mentioned has to do with smart meters. What's that legislation?
Well, smart meters are the devices that utility companies install in homes that have a wireless connection to their equipment that they allow to get the information they need about your energy usage. There is a concern that has arisen that this violates privacy and some backlash, and there was legislation that was introduced that would prevent utilities from installing these meters in the home of anybody who objected. And of course, some people are going to object. The utilities say, well, most of them are already installed. It's kind of a done deal. And also, it will cost lots of money for us to take these out. And also, we do have pretty strong privacy protections that this information would not be used or sold in ways that would violate people's privacy. So that bill hasn't gone anywhere.
I know that's something that has happened a lot in Madison, and there's some backlash against these smart meters. Is this something that's going on all over the state as well, and that's why supporters of this bill are getting
involved? Oh, absolutely.
Involved?
Sure. This is a statewide issue. It's a concern that's raised in certain quarters where people have a distrust of government and corporations and think that their privacy is imperiled by this technology. And, of course, the utility companies will argue against that. The opposition to the bill is fairly overwhelming. Of the lobby groups that have registered an opinion on this, I believe all of them have come out against it.
Well, another bill that did not make it this time around, it was a more recent one, a piece of legislation, wind energy suits, and people thinking about some of the damages that they may be incurring if they live near a wind farm.
Well, this is a really interesting bill because what has happened in the state of Wisconsin in the last couple of years, since Governor Walker was elected, is there has been a lot of legislation that makes it harder for people to sue companies if they think that their interests have been harmed. This is a bill that makes it easier for people to sue. If they live near a wind turbine and they feel that there are health consequences or there is a loss of property value, this would increase their ability to sue, would provide some attorney fee reimbursement. It would state as a matter of law that just being in compliance with all applicable laws would not be a defense against a lawsuit. It does cut dramatically against the grain of the what's called tort reform, which has swept Wisconsin. This bill has not had much luck getting out of the pack either. And again, the lobby opposition to it is fairly overwhelming. I believe 21 of the 24 groups who have registered an opinion on this bill are opposed.
And there's opposition within the Republican majority on this, right? Frank Lissay is the sponsor of this bill, and he's been pushing for it. But because of the tort reform issues you mentioned, as I understand it, a lot of Republicans aren't jumping on board with this.
That's probably the case. It certainly is not consistent with other actions that the Republicans have taken to make it more difficult for companies to find themselves in court paying out damages to people who say that they've been harmed.
Is this one that you would say has a good shot at moving forward next time around?
I do think that there certainly is support for it. It could move forward. It's one of those things. I mean, all it really takes is one committee chair who is against it to stop a bill. There's a lot of ways that a bill can be stopped, short of a veto from the governor, which is also a possibility in every case. This one here, it all depends.
So a lot of years in a row, it seemed like the top issue in front of the legislature were laws that said we should be able to hunt blank, and you fill in an animal there. Mourning doves was a biggie years ago.
Yeah, cranes.
This year, cranes, right. This year, woodchucks. A bill was proposed to allow a woodchuck hunt.
Yeah, it would create an open season on woodchucks. It would say that the DNR could not set a bag limit on the number of woodchucks that you could kill within the period of time that the hunt was open. This bill was introduced in April. It did have a hearing, but it has not advanced.
No bag limit. Do they usually in hunting bills set that kind of restraint on the DNR, saying you can't regulate the hunt we've created?
You know, you see that more and more, that the legislature is presuming to tell the DNR what it can't do. That's a big part of the proposal with regard to frac sand regulation, is it says the DNR cannot set stronger standards for frac sand mines and exist for other industries, blah, blah. It does. Again, that's another bill that constrains the ability of the regulator to regulate. I think we've seen some of that with regard to wetlands as well.
In terms of Democrat-backed bills that did not get a lot of traction, the Democrats were backing a slew, you know, a handful at least, of gun control legislation. They proposed it, and it has not gone anywhere. What is the state of some of these, things like banning assault weapons and large-capacity magazines? Where are we with some of this gun control legislation?
Well, the one that the Democrats are most keen on would require background checks for most firearm sales. This is something that has passed in some other states, particularly in the wake of Sandy Hook and other tragedies of the sort. It has enormous public support. I heard one of the advocates say recently that the support for background checks in the state of Wisconsin is on a par with the support that people have for Aaron Rodgers. Both enjoy like 90% approval in the opinion polls that have been done. But this bill appears dead on arrival. The Republicans have not had hearings on it. They've not advanced this in any way. As I say in the column, the legislation regarding background checks, regarding assault weapons, regarding high-capacity magazines, and a bill that would prohibit the carrying of concealed weapons in the state capitol, which is not allowed, all have gone nowhere, which is expected to be their final destination.
Is this pretty common in when we make lists of bills that don't pass, the minority party advancing legislation that they know isn't going to pass, but they do it because it's their agenda, it's what they use to reach out to their supporters?
Absolutely. We saw that yesterday with the introduction of a proposal that the citizens of Wisconsin should have the right to vote on an advisory referendum on the question of redistricting. The Democratic lawmakers proposed that. They would like to see an advisory referendum on the ballot in 2014. I think it was the Associated Press today, or maybe it was the State Journal's article that just said, as a matter of fact, this bill has virtually no chance of passage. The Republicans who control the legislature have not even wanted to hold hearings on bills that would create a nonpartisan redistricting process. The idea of having a advisory referendum is probably not going to be embraced by the party, but it might be embraced by individual Republican lawmakers. That will be an interesting thing. Yeah, I think a lot of times parties who are out of power will advance legislation, will introduce legislation that they think ought to be law, even though they know that it's politically unlikely.
Is part of that it might sit there dormant and be used as a template later on when the party's back in power?
Yes. And a lot of times it takes years of proposing legislation before it gains the type of support that it needs. We saw that over the past couple decades with restrictions on smoking in restaurants and bars and things like that. That was legislation that was introduced many times and failed before it gained acceptance and passed.
You also write about some campaign finance law changes that that may actually happen, I think, campaign disclosure laws.
Yeah, there is a number of things that would tinker with our campaign finance system. The one that I think is most likely to pass is was actually introduced as an amendment to another bill. You can't find it in the bill itself, but there's an amendment to a proposed bill that would double the amount of money that candidates for most state races could receive from a particular contributor. It raised the maximum contribution for the governor's race, for instance, from $10,000 to $20,000. It would raise from the maximum contribution for a state assembly race from $500 to $1,000, for Senate from $1,000 to $2,000. It would double all of these amounts. That, I think, does have a chance of passage because getting more money from contributors is something that has bipartisan support.
So we talked about a lot of hot-button legislation that didn't move forward, and then there was rubber duck races.
Yeah, rubber duck races. That, you know, I started looking into this thinking it was a joke, and most of the press attention that is received has taken that tone, that this is a funny thing. There's a proposal before the legislature now that would specifically allow charitable groups to have raffles and contests that people bet on that involve racing rubber or plastic ducks. And the more I looked into it, though, the more I realized it's not actually that bad of an idea. There are a number of charitable groups around the state that have had these contests that involve rubber ducks. Some of them have received letters from the Justice Department notifying them that this is not an approved form of gambling under our laws. And the law does have to change for these contests, these promotions to be legal.
In our last minute, Bill, you mentioned before we started here that you don't have to be the only one to dig up this information. You're trying to provide tools for people to be watchdogs on what's going on in the state government.
Yeah, that's very much one of the things we try to do at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism is to share the knowledge that it takes to do this kind of poking around. We just published this week on our website, wisconsinwatch.org. On the front page, you'll see a resource guide for watchdogs, a watchdog toolkit, and it contains some tips and some links for using some of the resources that I use to report these stories. For instance, a link that will take you to the page where you can look at all of the legislation that is introduced. You can drill down and you can see what the status of it is. You can look at the analysis that's been done. You can look at fiscal estimates. You can research the support that's received from special interest groups.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
That was Bill Leaders, reporter for the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.